at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, we embrace with love.
Let's do it right now.
Yes, we do have to have peace, y'all. We got to have peace here right in St. Louis. We seem to have chaos and destruction all over the world, but we're going to do it right. We're going to have to plan to the long haul, the long fight to correct all this stuff and transform the world that we're living in. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are live at the Black Radio Hall of Fame here at the Historically Black University, Harris Stowe. I need to tell you that the opinions and expressed on Black Radio Hall of Fame are those of me and my guests and not necessarily those of Harris Stowe State University or the Black Radio Hall of Fame. But we hope that you will still listen and absorb, break down and all of that good stuff as you hear some of the opinions being expressed on this radio show. So before I introduce you to our guest, I want to go back a couple of episodes ago when we had Thomas Mines on the show, because I remember Thomas Mines is one of the first loan officers at Gateway National Bank, the first and only black-owned bank in the city of St. Louis. And there were questions about whether or not the Gateway Credit Union on Union near Natural Bridge is in fact black-owned, and it is not. What happened with that? They took the name Gateway as a honor of what was on that site. The original Gateway Bank was on that site, and so when they built the branch, they wanted to honor that sacred ground. And so if you go into the lobby, you'll see some of the historic pictures of those folks who were part of the founding of Gateway National Bank. But Gateway Bank, as it exists now, it's part of the St. Louis credit community. Community Credit Union, and they have many, many branches over the region, and that's just one of them. So no, Gateway Credit Union is not black-owned. We do not have, and I'm going to repeat, we do not have a black-owned financial institution here in the city of St. Louis, but maybe that'll change, because a couple of years ago, Kansas City, created their first credit union, black-owned credit union. So maybe we will follow the leadership of our sister city. So thank you for joining us. And we have Sandra Keeley with us today, and we're going to be talking about Second Chance Month. And, you know, sometimes I zero in on these months and days and, you know, wherever they're saying, like, we need to focus on something. But really, and you've heard me say this, we need to be thinking about this stuff on a regular basis, not just in the month of April, because second chances is important when we got a country like ours that is hell-bent on incarcerating its citizens. So I want to welcome Sandra Keeley to the show today. How are you, Sandra?
I am just excited to see you and to be in your space and to, you know, perhaps share some very vital information with our St. Louis listening audience. So you're worldwide, aren't you? You're online.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay. Worldwide. Yes. So I want you to talk a bit about what you do, and then I think we can segue into Second Chance Month, because a lot of the work you do in the community embraces that work, leans into that work, taps into that work, does that work. So talk about what Sandra Keeley does.
I started a journey in doing real estate development way back in 1982, when the interest rates were 19.5%. So when people are whining about 8%, I'm like, you all weren't born when I started my real estate journey. And in that, there are so many paths that feed into real estate. So ultimately, I managed a mortgage company. And then 2008 hit. So we're looking at this process of cycles. So in 2008, everything blew up. And I went through a divorce. And so consequently, I had to reimagine myself. So a very dear, dear friend from childhood called me, who was the executive director of a reentry program. And she said, Sandra, we need someone to help them find employment. We take them through this process. We give them a certificate and then just crickets. So I told my girlfriend, I said, well, if I can get them a job, I can sell them a house. So everything had to feed back into real estate. So off I go, and I put together this whole program of career development. And it was one of my most gratifying experiences because we were like small group, and we became family. And one of the things that was the most fun was I helped them envision a future. So we did vision boards. We had people getting up there and talking about their hopes and dreams for the future and having the support of the group, applause. We did things like went on field trips to a job fair. So things like that that you and I take for granted, there's a population, they don't know what to expect, how to behave, how to act. So we did the field trip, we came back and debriefed it, and everybody was just so happy and full of gratitude. So with our program, we had like a 90% success rate in placing individuals. And at that time, the casino had came, and they had promised Slate 25 positions for the justice involved. And one of the young ladies in our program, she had an armed robbery conviction, but when we took her through the program, she got hired at the burger bar at the casino. And in my mind, oh, you letting this young lady be around money? But we were transforming lives. Mm. And there's this one story that really has touched my heart. So his name was Jimmy, and we were sitting around talking about the various emotional states. There's a range of emotions. Mm. Hope, joy, contentment, and anger is at the bottom of this scale. So I'm like, okay, we know brother's got it down on the anger piece. And I said, it's a critical, important emotion that will sometimes propel you toward excellence. I said, but just don't get stuck there. And when I said that, Jamala, his face just lit up. And I said, okay, Jimmy, looks like you heard what I was saying. Why are you
here? He had an aha moment.
Yeah, he did. I said, and why are you here anyway? He said, they call me Miss Sandra. And he said, Miss Sandra, I got two boys. One is 2, 1 is 4. I got to take care of my boys. That was on a Friday. When he came back Monday to the group, he had 2 jobs.
Wow.
So in my journey, I understood that everybody wants to have this story heard. And they're listening for someone to give them permission that this thought and their spirit, and someone is saying, you know, anger, you got to use it, but please, there is a full range. Mm-hmm. And so that was, to this day, had such an impact on me. But in addition to that, I served on the domestic violence docket for St. Louis Family Court. That was very amazing because domestic violence crosses all economic categories, mm-hmm. sexist, gender. And in my intention, I had no idea that I would be sworn in as a citizen deputy juvenile officer. So Judge Michael Burton swore me in. So I started going down to the courts and getting people out of jail under my supervision. Who knew? So here we go. Mm. So I kept being drawn in to this whole criminal justice piece. But the number one thing happened in 1988 when I got a call from my brother, Frantic, he's in Michigan, saying he had just been sentenced to 50 years in prison. And he told me, he said, Sandra, I had a public defender. When the judge hit the gavel and said 50 years, he burst out laughing. He said, this has got to be a joke for a small so-called third degree assault. Him and his girlfriend got into this little tussle. Because, you know, you can, if you yell at somebody loud, you can get charged third degree assault. So that's my only brother out of the 8 girls. And this man was a licensed pilot. He could fly planes. So how many of our precious jewels, our brilliant ones, are incarcerated? So I had said if there was anything I could do to relieve the suffering of someone caught into the system, I was all in.
Wow. And I'm glad you told that story, Sandra, because oftentimes when I have guests on, I want them to talk about that journey, because I have to tell young people where you start is not always where you end. And so if you heed the calling, or sometimes people see something in you that you don't see, and they say, you probably need to be doing this. And so a lot of times where we start is, it seems like it's completely different, but I think the way that you wove it together shows the interrelationship of all of those things, even though the centerpiece was criminal justice, it was all these other issues that were going to be impacted. So really just publicly want to thank you for that work that you've been doing for so many years. And, you know, trying to do something with the criminal justice system in America is more than a notion. It is a very hard nut to crack, because this is a system that's hell-bent on punishment, not rehabilitation, not restorative justice. And so it's no surprise that 1 out of 4 of people are either incarcerated or under supervision. So for me, when I look at those kinds of numbers, it almost, in some ways, nullifies the stigma of being incarcerated. Because, as you said, you could have a nonviolent offense. You could have, you know, stolen a pencil. But yet you're going to be tagged the same way a person who actually killed somebody. So then it starts to be, well, what do we have here? We don't even have a discriminatory system where you got people who are nonviolent. They get a certain separation and a certain kind of approach. But in this case, everybody gets thrown in together, and, you know, never the twain shall meet. And I just think that's one of the most egregious parts of this criminal justice system. But speak to the fact that we got this carceral system where people, regardless, can expect to have a themselves or a loved one be part of this oppressive system.
Well, the saying is, if any one person in your family is incarcerated, the whole family
That's
is
right.
incarcerated.
That's right.
And the emails, the flying up to Michigan to visit with my brother, he's completed 35 years of his 50. Mm-hmm. And in his journey, he survived throat cancer, and he just had a below-the-knee amputation. Because there is a spirit that is so strong in some of us that they stand until righteousness prevails. And my brother is determined at some point to come home.
He's going
to
walk out of that place.
Get
wheeled out. Whatever the case may be, he's getting out of there. He's going to see sunlight.
And we keep encouraging him. And because family connection is critical, so many people after that many years, family members have died off. You know, there's no one really mindful of the fact that they're still here and that they still have dreams and goals and aspirations, and we have to continue to pour into that, whether it's an email or call, because if you know for a fact this system is the new plantation, as I look at the population and I've done my research, I would say easily 35% of the people incarcerated are innocent.
Oh, yes, for sure.
Because
for
of the sure. system of the plea bargain.
Right, right.
And so then you have another third that's in there, this over-sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you give my brother 50 years and he didn't kill anybody?
Mm.
And the same judge gave a young man 15 years who hit a curb and the vehicle flipped and someone died. He gets 15 years. Well, my brother gets 50.
So I just have to stop and ask you this as somebody that's been an advocate for in this whole system with people who are going to be railroaded. I know he had a public defender, but did he get somebody interested enough in this case to appeal that sentence?
He hired a gentleman that supposedly had the juice, but he ended up with just money down a dark hole.
Wow.
Because in the state of Michigan, they have historically stolen people's lives. Mm-hmm. I know there was a 60-minute story about how horrific Michigan was, and that's been 20 years ago. So in my journey, I'm encouraged because you have a politic in Michigan. You have a governor that's Democratic, a lieutenant governor, and a secretary of state. So I'm pulling together some resources because, you know, it's a little hard when it's long distance.
Yes,
you know
it is. It's hard when it's in the same state.
But again, the cycle and my way of thinking and understanding my path and how I've been led and directed, that he will, from some of the resources, finally be liberated, because there's a federal agency that is called FAM, and they have what they call compassionate release. So, of course, he's no longer potentially a menace to society by any stretch of the imagination, but Michigan does not have compassionate release. Mm-hmm. And the law that they have on the books, they end up just putting you in an institution like he is now. Mm-hmm. Let him come home.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm starting to amass some individuals that I think can point that out, that Michigan, it's time for compassionate release. It's a budgetary concern. Why are you spending money housing these people in their 70s and their 60s
and 80s?
Especially because his sister, she desperately wants him to come home. She wants to take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
So that is sort of what's been going on. So it's a season now. There's a season. And as we're speaking about Second Chance Month, it came out of Second Chance Act that was passed in 2008. So whoever is the president, they'll do a proclamation to support the act.
Yeah.
And at that time, they looked at 2.2 million in cages.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, someone sat up in bed out of a nightmare is like, what are we doing?
Mm.
So we're looking at eventually those people are coming back into society with all these obstacles and barriers,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
employment,
yeah.
Homelessness.
Yeah.
We all know the top five.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they passed the Second Chance Act. They have invested, right? At the time, they appropriated like $16.5 million for state and local tribal organizations to come up with some services, mm-hmm. or a blueprint for these individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So now, because I received a seed grant from Forward Through Ferguson with the aspiration to streamline the expungement process in St. Louis City, my organization, Three Daughters and 1,000 Sons, my goal is to expunge 1,000 criminal records.
Mm.
And so as things were rolling out, I saw Second Chance Month as being a point of attention for something like this.
Absolutely.
And it was just so beautiful how, because I could tell you some other stories about my court involvement. I had a client that sued me for $5 million because I showed him a house that had mold. It was a federal property, but I represented myself for 2 years, pro se, in a federal $5 million lawsuit. And my judge at the time was Judge Stephen Limbaugh, Rush Limbaugh's brother.
Yeah.
But it was such a... You'd have to go through that whole process. Mm-hmm. It went for 2 years, but I ended up being successful, and the guy that sued us, he settled.
Yeah, so let me, I really wanted to take a deeper dive into the Second Chance, but because you mentioned your brother and you mentioned him being in an out-of-state prison, I really want us to go into that a little bit more, because one of the things, and you know I've written about this over the years in the St. Louis American and other places, about the criminal justice system, and the point that you made about the family is also in prison. One of the things that I don't think we got a grip on is, first of all, the emotional, psychological cost. Sometimes we can figure out the financial cost, because, you know, the phone call is expensive coming from prison.
Mm-hmm.
And now they got it so that they can only get stuff from the internal commissary. You can't send them anything, so they have to have money on the books. So some of that is, you can, you know, it's tangible enough that you can add up. But when I'm thinking about, you know, families driving up to see their loved ones, you know, raising money to try to do something in Missouri prisons, they finally did something that was halfway compassionate, and that was like families could bring food. So a lot of the times there's a Sunday that, you know, if you've been behaving yourself, your family can bring all this delicious food, homemade kind of thing. But, you know, you're going through all these other changes where there's literally cost involved, but we haven't calculated that. So for you, where did you see, for example, the cost financially, the cost psychologically? You got eight sisters, so all of that was spread amongst them as a family, and then you have your other family. I don't know if he had children.
Yeah, he had a son and a daughter.
So the impact on them, you know, because sometimes, you know, our young people who have folks in prison, they don't fare well. And there's studies that say that as well. And so, what did you see when you were first confronted with the fact that this brother got 50 years and what that was going to mean for your family?
Well, it's crazy because at the time he called, I was 8 months pregnant with my oldest child. So that was a shock. And the proof in the pudding is the way it just put me on a whole different trajectory in terms of my career, because I'm doing criminal justice reform. So it's so deep in my DNA. I'm like, I get all these newsletters. I'm always scrolling, and what's the latest, and how can I make a difference here on the ground? So, over the years, we were involved with the St. Louis Alliance for Reentry. And I'll never forget how Nancy McCarthy, she spoke. She said, any given day, and she's with the state at the time, any given day you have 17,000 people on the streets of St. Louis that are just as involved. So we're standing next to our brothers and sisters at the bank, mm-hmm. at the grocery store, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. at the gas station. So this point that you're making, the thing that's so heartbreaking to me is that there seems to be an attitude of not in my backyard.
Right.
I don't want you to live next to me. I don't want this. I don't want that. But there is no escape.
It's not.
There is no escape. So one of the prayers that I have, that I'll find the narrative to help people understand whether you like it or not. So we need to have an attitude of welcoming. Mm-hmm. So in my real estate journey, one thing that I have conceived is a real estate development that I call the Prodigal Project. So, you know, in the Bible, the son went off and did his thing, and he ended up coming back home, but his dad partied with them, laid it out. So if we could start having more, if we're Christian, okay?
And even if you're just good human beings, you don't even have to be a Christian, but if that's your belief system,
right,
then
exactly.
You compel to uphold it.
But some of us say our goodness is tied to the book, so that's why I make reference mm-hmm. to that. But I'm truly a spiritual person, because mm-hmm. the Lord told me before there was ink to a page, he was. So I just use everything at my disposal, and I was just inspired by that story, because we all fall short.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that you count 1, 2, 3. The third person is just as impacted, whether it's a family member or themselves personally.
Mm-hmm.
Some stories I am just happy to repeat. I was at a expungement clinic waiting on my daughter to pick me up. And this young lady, she trudges up. Now it's about 5:30. And she says, is this where the clinic is? I said, yes, but it's over. She said, no. She said, I had to work today. I caught 2 buses. I have 5 kids. And this thing is keeping me from getting my CNA.
Mm.
That's just one story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, so then what I hear you saying is that the ability to earn a living is connected with your with your sentence. And so what, and this also leads to the recidivism rate too, Sandra, because if you can't find a job, then what do you do to take care of yourself and your family? And so a lot of it we don't think about. And I always say that if we really are going to do the job right, we have to create communities that are pro-social and pro-human so that we don't have as many people going. But certainly when they come back, it ought to be a welcoming, loving, nurturing community that we're showing some grace, because these folks have been through a lot. And to your point about, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, you do the crime, you do the time. Well, if you understand the system, a lot of these folks haven't done the crime, and the time is too damn harsh. So now what? You know, for somebody to have a domestic sentence for 50 years. I mean, I'm thinking about one of the cases the Organization for Black Struggle is working on of Frederico Lobe. He was wrongly accused of rape, and he's already served 36 years. That's more than some people, as you said, who have killed people. And so it's like, well, how is these disparities still allowed to exist? And sometimes it's based on the judge, it's based on the prosecuting attorney, it's based on the jury. It is so subjective that we can't even predict what would happen to you if you get wrongfully accused, because sometimes people think, oh, I'm innocent, so that's going to be proven in court. Not just ask Lamar Johnson about that, okay? So we got this kind of notion that we've been infected with the ideology that these folks did wrong, they should be punished, and not only should they be punished once, but once they get out, they're going to get doubly punished, because now they can't get student loans, they can't live in public housing. I mean, the list goes on and on about what they can't do when they get out here. So how are they supposed to pick themselves up and not recidivate? I mean, really?
Well, we have to, whatever tools that we have at our disposal, and it's multi-pronged, and one thing that we need to really get in our core is this power of the vote. So it's not about the party. It's not about the age of a person. It's your interest. And I am working with a young man that some of these judges and prosecutors and sheriffs, they run on these campaigns that I'm going to lock them up and throw away the key.
And they have done that.
Yes. So we have to understand just how that one vote, it can really just transform everything. And I never will forget the one, the ad that came out some years ago about take your booty to the polls. Do you remember this, the pole dancers? I love it. Because they were saying, look, you know, your vote is all, politics are local.
Mm-hmm.
Your vote, that's the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. Then they went down that list. And so I'm like, they said, they're just trying to be creative. The people just reaching out. But mm-hmm. I thought, I loved it.
But when I think about incarceration, I cannot help but think about trauma and mental health issues, which means that once our loved ones come out, it's not just about finding them a job. They have to get socially and psychologically ready for reentry. And, you know, a friend of mine that had to be incarcerated, I wouldn't say incarcerated, he had to go to the city's justice center for a charge, and he said being in there for a week was worse than him serving time, and he served time in two different states. He felt like he was traumatized. And he said, I think that's saying something for somebody like me. So think about somebody who has never committed a crime and he goes to the Justice Center. Maybe there was a administrative snafu that got them there. Like they were supposed to have been taken out, or they supposed to have shown that they paid their tickets. And now all of a sudden they end up here, and look at the conditions that they're going to become. So one of the things I often say is, let's create a system, even though I'm a abolitionist when it comes to prisons.
Same here.
In the meantime, can we create a system that if you went in there as a innocent citizen, what would you want to see? And so that's the thing that I think drives me to really for fighting for certain reforms. It's like, if I had to go in that place, what would I need? What would I need to have? in order for that stay to be meaningful and not traumatic. And so what have you heard from folks who have been in the system around the mental health piece? That, 'cause sometimes I don't think people understand what has happened to them based on institutionalization, and in certain prisons they're worse than others. And so you just get used to that modality, and then when you come out, you be like, oh, I don't know what's wrong with me. And you can't be the diagnoser of your own problem. So what are we doing there, and how can we really raise people's awareness about that?
Well, I'm sort of encouraged, and, you know, it's really crazy how good can come out of evil. So I attended a grant writing workshop in Kansas City last year, and they were talking about the $6 billion that are being appropriated for mental health, because rather than have common sense gun laws, they say, well, we'll just throw money at the mental health situation. And so there are lots of resources that are going to be available. So we have to just look for those notices. But then are there enough for mental health professionals that can meet the need?
Well, that's what I was going to challenge you when you said there's going to be lots of resources. I think there's going to be money coming down the pike, but I don't know who they go to, because we're still looking for, like, when I have to refer somebody, I'm like, okay,
right.
This big old wide Rolodex. It's like, you know, five groups that I know or five people that I know that can do this work well for our people, because you got to be culturally sensitive about what our folks have been through, especially people in prison.
So I look at our professional mental health associations and look to them to seize the time. There are resources. It's our community. Because right now it's just like people are from their heart. They have a passion for it. Perhaps some of our churches could get properly trained, trauma informed. Because in the congregations, you have some individuals that have that background, nurses. So it's almost like in a war, you have to gear up for battle.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, a war against our mental health like never before. So we're having to gear up. So we have to have these conversations where we can build up our troops to be able to meet the need. So on a personal tip, my nephew of mine, Carnell McKay, who was falsely accused of armed robbery case in the Central West End when the young lady that was here playing volleyball was murdered in the Central West End. I've known him from birth. He's just a big, goofy kid. He's a tattooist, but he got caught up in the system. And they literally, he was at the Justice Center for 3 years, and then they convicted him to 12 years for something he didn't do. But because there is a God, truly, there were resources that came to him, and retired Judge James Dowd represented him and got him exonerated. But in the meantime, there were no resources. The police department bucked his case. It was something that they did,
mm-hmm.
meaning when the lady got robbed of her cell phone and her $50, she gave them her phone record. And instead of them going through the phone record to see who was using the phone, they didn't, so then the young lady in the Central West End got murdered. So he had been fighting for some restitution, but it was just undaunting. It was daunting, rather. So he lives in Texas now. He loves the state.
Got the hell on out of the state of misery.
Mm-hmm. For real, for mm-hmm. real. But we have this conversation. He say, Auntie Sandra, I'm suffering PTSD.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, he said, what was done to me? And then there was no justice as what was done to me. So I try to kind of keep him anchored, and I say he should plug into some organizations, but he complains that he can't get food stamps. All these things
mm-hmm.
are not available to him.
Mm-hmm.
So on a personal tip, all I can do is just let him talk,
mm-hmm.
hear him express his pain,
mm-hmm.
try to get a little humor out of him so he can go and through another day.
And I don't know if people remember that case. I remember it vividly because to me it was another example of how quickly cases that involved white people get solved. even if they have to snatch the wrong person, that book is going to be closed in 24 to 48 hours. You can best believe that. And so I had all kind of feelings for that young woman who was murdered. And yes. Of course you want some justice out of that, correct. But don't just start grabbing folks. That's not going to be helpful because here's the thing that happens with wrongful conviction, and you know, I've worked on most of the cases for Missouri, even with the Allen Reasonover case. You then have to, after all those years of trying to exonerate yourself, the trail has gone cold. People have died. People's memories have lapsed. So the family never really gets justice because now this person is exonerated. It's clear either through DNA or false testimony or whatever that they were not the person. So you still as a family have absolutely no closure. And I just, that's one of the pieces I always try to emphasize in wrongful convictions. Yeah, this person got exonerated and that's good, but what about the family who lost somebody? They still will probably never know who killed their loved ones because folks were so adamant about closing the case and lying and fabricating evidence, all that they do to get a conviction, that now it's too late almost. It's too late. So if you're just joining us, we have Sandra Keeley in the studio with us. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are talking about April being Second Chance Month. And there are so many reasons, y'all, why we need to have grace for our people that are coming out who deserve a second chance. They've done their time, okay? That's what society told them to do. You do the crime, do the time, and many of them have. And some of them served all of their time. You know, sometimes you can get good behavior. A lot of these folks have served all the way up to the time that they were supposed to. But when they come out, what do they have waiting for them? And oftentimes, there's more challenges outside in terms of trying to reenter and be a good citizen than they were even in terms of serving the sentence. You know, there was a piece on the Father Support Center on TV, and of course that's one of my favorite, you know, organizations because they're doing the similar kind of work of like really one-on-one and establishing relationships with these brothers that have come out and want to be with their kids. That's the other thing, folks. Oh, they dead, be dead. So I remember one of the columns that I did for the St. Louis American, I got a number of ugly letters, from people saying, you know, you coddle these people. They don't need to be in no damn program. They need to be a good father. They need to pay child support. Well, here's the thing. Most folks, and I'm talking about most people in this country, probably the world, whether they've been incarcerated or not, people need to learn parenting skills. I mean, we don't know nothing else and realize and can sum that up. People need help parenting. And so for them to have a program that helps you do that, helps you expunge your records, help you be a good father, one that can take care of your kids, love your kids, why would you not want to exalt a program like that? So I'm just thinking about there's people doing the work, not enough of them, because if we got one out of four, we still don't have enough groups doing this work, but they do good work, and, you know, they got lots of testimonies, but most of the time we're not too welcoming, you know, as a community. And I know, you know, in the black community, we get our fair share of crime and we're sick of it. We're weary. Everybody looks like a criminal because that's the way they have conditioned us. You know, everybody's a pookie, you know, ready to like, you know, snatch my purse. So we don't have that kind of environment yet. What do you think it's going to take for us to have an environment where we truly understand what somebody who's been incarcerated has gone through and what their needs are once they get out?
I think we just need to have the conversations, first of all, because even when I encounter people that have been in the system, their minds are locked down, and it can be tough to, you know, help those individuals because there's been so much rejection.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that a lot of people have heard, and it's meaningful to me now, that how do you eat an elephant?
One bite at a time.
So my three daughters and 1,000 sons is my effort to eat the elephant one bite at a time. I do have three daughters, and at the time when I was doing the career development, they looked at me as a mother figure. And, you know, I mentioned to you the reason why I chose the number 1,000 is that it means spiritual and divine protection and completion. And in our, and I'll make reference to the Bible, 1,000 is quoted 512 times in the book. So there is a lot of spiritual currency associated with that number. And when I applied for the grant, that was my goal. I will expunge 1,000 criminal records. I had some proteges that I would take for drug testing. This one gentleman had a record, but he ended up being hired at a manufacturing plant in Maryland Heights that was paying him $30 an hour. Mm-hmm. So there are some really good opportunities, because they claim that there is a shrinking work force.
Mm-hmm.
And there it's
yes,
like,
they do. And we're going to see that out there, but what's up with that? Yeah, they,
exactly.
Yeah, they haven't gone out to space. I mean, they're still here. What are you talking about?
Yes. And so, again, everybody is programmed that on average when they see a black man, danger, danger. And like I got all these stories. So my daughter lived in Winston Churchill, and a woman had died. And her sister was there cleaning out her apartment.
And she's talking about Winston Churchill apartments over
yes.
there on Cabinet. So
yes.
some of us are familiar with that.
Yes. And so her sister had this gigantic wheelie cart with all these Bibles. Her sister had been an evangelist. And so I was like, what are you going to do with those? She was going to put them in the dumpster. So I said, I'll take them. So I'm carrying these Bibles around in my Kia, giving them away. So one day, I was in a 4800 block of Farland, and I literally heard somebody murdered two doors down from me. So I went and I put a shrine out there. So it seemed like it was the anniversary of the young man losing his life. So these four guys were standing in the middle of the street, embracing like they were doing prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So this 100 block of Farland is one way, so I'm just being respectful. So they saw me, so they kind of pulled over to the curb. So I pulled up. I said, hey, you guys want some Bibles? And I opened up my trunk, and I was like, hey, how about this one? And I said, this one I'm going to keep. That's the one that the guy wanted. And I was hugging them, and it was like, people are hurting.
They are hurting.
They are hurting. And I know that I made a difference just giving out the Bibles. And I was encouraging them. I said, just go and sit in a sanctuary.
Mm.
And so those are the, so one bite at a time. I'm working on that elephant.
And one of the bites is going to be happening this weekend, y'all. So make a note of this. I'm going to try to have it on my website soon, probably today. But let's get into what's happening the big day this coming up, and who's going to be there.
The 27th?
Yeah.
April.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, as I have combined all of my hats, so as a mortgage origination vice president, I look at your criminal record like I look at a credit report. So in order for my clients to get their houses, I was helping them write letters, and some of the things were literally expunged, and they were successful. And so as a person familiar with looking at this type of paperwork, and because Senator Jamila Nasheed and others have done such an incredible job of increasing the list of charges that are eligible for expungement, I had said that I would have a process where I would help expunge 1,000 petitions. So on Saturday, in looking at the form itself, you are literally suing the state. And on that petition form, you have the prosecutor, you have the sheriff, you have the highway department, and you have the judge. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And yes.
Mm-hmm.
Judge May, White. I'm thinking of another judge. Judge White is the one that says, so ordered.
Mm-hmm.
So I invited them to come and help people understand this process, and to also invite them to collaborate with increasing public safety from their position of power. And just like the lady that can't get a CNA because. So that was intentional, mm-hmm. the people that I invited, and they were very welcoming and excited to participate.
And you want to talk about who some of those folks are? You talked about Jamila Nasheed, and of course, you know, she has to be there because in her role both as a state rep and a state senator, that was one of her babies, you know, expungement and, you know, more focus on the criminal justice system. And so I'm excited to see that she'll be here there.
So I have invited Sheriff Vernon Betts.
Okay.
Because in his role, he has some involvement, some impact. And then Judge Joseph White. Interestingly enough, you sue for your expungement in an equity court. So I look forward to him explaining why equity court as opposed to the criminal court. Right. But that is his wheelhouse. And then we also have Lois Jackson from the Circuit Attorney's Office. I had sought Attorney Gore, but there is another event earlier in the day at St. Louis University, and if people can't make mine at 2 to 4 at the Central Library Auditorium, I encourage them to attend. It's the Public Safety Summit.
Mm-hmm. And so again, that's what Dr. Kristen Griffith is doing.
Yes, yes.
So at this event, I just want people to be clear on the format. There will be people explaining their particular role in their offices in this process,
yes.
but also there's going to be opportunity for people to actually fill out the petition for expungement. Is that correct?
Not at that time.
Okay, not at that time.
Because it's that we need more than 2 hours or something like that. But, Three Daughters and 1,000 Sons will be actually having a clinic in June. And so I hope to, partner with, Senator Carla May. She does one once a year. But like you're saying, we need this to be round the clock. So she has her effort annually. And the ACLU in their last clinic, they're asking for volunteers. They realize once a year is not uh-huh. enough. That's just for Christmas.
Right.
Christmas is once a year. But so, no, we won't be doing the petitions. But it's like massaging the people's minds that this is an opportunity and that as they gain more information and as we create a collaboration of those individuals that can impact whether or not you mm-hmm. get that expungement, that's the point of Saturday.
Right.
Because you're not going to have to be dealing with an email or leaving a voicemail. They're there.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be able to ask questions
mm-hmm.
and just get the okay. information that you're seeking.
So I'm thinking, Sandra, that people who need that expungement in a timely way, they're not going to be able to wait till July when somebody has something. Can there be some kind of directory of those dates so that people say, okay, this is coming up. I need to go there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I know my website is still under construction, but I purpose to put that on my website.
Okay.
But if they go to the ACLU website, they have a whole every month. But then I think they're looking to fill out those dates because mm-hmm. they were asking if you went to the one at Harris Stowe State University,
mm-hmm.
They were looking for volunteers at that time.
Right. Because if we could have something monthly, no matter which group is doing it, then
right.
we could announce on, because I want to make sure you get your 1,000.
Yeah. Girl, that's going to be so easy. 500,000 Missourians
mm.
are eligible for expungement for nonviolent and non-sexual crimes. We're talking 500,000.
Probably 300,000 of them here in this region, right?
Yes. And when I was talking to Judge Draper, he's going to be our moderator. He laughed. He said, yeah, 1,000. Figure you can probably knock that out with no time.
Yeah,
no time.
Exceed your goals.
Yes. So, again, that's another thing that Three Daughters and 1,000 Sons is proposing to do is to, again, bring awareness and exposure because you have these clinics that are going on because, unfortunately, at the one at Harris Stowe State University, I think only about 25 people showed up.
Mm.
Because how are they getting the word out?
Yeah, yeah.
So my team, my street team, they're hitting the black barbershops.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The beauty salons.
Right, right.
Wherever we know there is a town hall, State Representative Kimberly Collins had a town hall this weekend that was powerful. So I go and I show her the flyer and she says, that's already in my newsletter. She went, cause she's out there on social media. So she saw it. So it's all about making our community be like those drums, the native drums, like we communicate with each other.
Yeah.
So the more conversation, I think the more accepting. Cause like you say, how do you get your own people to recognize we, that's Pookie. That's my nephew. That's my brother.
Yeah.
That's your niece.
Right, right. I remember, one column I had written about, the criminal justice system, and I got a letter from, a mother who had a son in prison. This is a church going mom, and she was saying, you know, I'm sitting up here in church every Sunday and I can't even get the church to recognize that they got members whose children are in prison. And it's almost like if you don't say it, it doesn't exist. And she was saying, I really so appreciate you taking it out of the shadows. And I want to take it out of the shadows because too many of us are involved and we have to be silent because we, that stigma. Because if you got a son in prison or a daughter, then people start looking at, well, what did you do wrong? And I'm telling you, you don't have to do a daggone thing wrong. It's a society that's got a mark on that child's back from the beginning of life. And all you could do is try to hover over them to protect them. But at some point in time, you're gonna turn your head and boom, there they are. Either gonna be killed by the police, gonna be snatched up by the police. And so I just think as a community, we just have to be more aware of all the forces that are interacting with us and our children in ways that we don't even understand.
Yeah, I sent a call out to some marketing expert out there to come up with a little catchy phrase or something that will encapsulate that particular situation. There's an organization called Reform Alliance that was started by Jay-Z and Van Jones and a couple of other millionaires, and they targeted the fact that parole is a sentence. There are so many states that you are eternally on parole.
Exactly. Missouri's one of them. People get 20 years. They get more parole than sentence.
So to their credit, they had like, tell us your story. So I told them about my brother. They called me. However, he's not on parole, so they could not assist me.
Mm-hmm.
But they are kind of sweeping the nation. Mm. They're going state by state, and they are really having an impact. So they have a campaign where now they're saying, you matter. That's what they're telling everybody in the audience. These people matter. You matter.
But can you imagine, Sandra, you out on parole and every breath, every that you take, every step that you take, you are worried about going back. Because you don't know what's around you. You know, you could be somewhere where somebody has a weapon. You're not supposed to be around somebody with a weapon. You don't know when you go in a public space who has a weapon or not. I mean, so I just think it's entrapment of the worst kind. And you have to be under so much stress trying to figure out where I can go, where I can't go, who's going, you know, all of that. And I just think it's so unfair. And that once you've done your time,
you should be done.
You should be done.
But no.
But part of this is helping to keep the system going, because you at some point probably going to stumble and then you're going to go back. You parole violations. That's what those folks in the Justice Center, a lot of them have parole violations. So they're going to go right back in and start the process all over again. It's just a tragedy of immense proportions that we as a nation ought to be just ashamed about, but ashamed enough not to just wallow in guilt, but to really then do something about it. So I want to thank you, Sandra Keeley, for joining us today and bringing all this rich information. I want you to say again where this week's activity is going to be and how people can get there. Is there a price to it? What?
No, it's free. Our town hall is called Demystifying the Expungement Process. It will be held at the Central Library, 1301 Olive Boulevard Auditorium. And the parking is free at 15th and Olive. The code is 2404#. So I want people to make sure they take advantage of the free parking. I am so delighted when I see my tax dollars being really put at work, and the library system, they're a pattern for others to follow. They have really met the community, what their interests
exactly.
are.
Exactly.
And this auditorium is worthy of our use.
Absolutely.
And it's from 2 to 4. So
yeah.
that's April 27th.
Okay. So we want to encourage people, even if you're not directly impacted, and you probably are, but to pass the word on for folks that you may know need to be there, because that expungement is a process that you really have to understand if you're going to be successful. Because, you know, sometimes people start writing letters to people saying, help me, and those are the wrong people. So then they get frustrated, like, nobody won't help me. Well, you got to ask the right person. You got to knock on the right door. So this is what's going to be happening on Saturday, the 27th, down at the Central Library, and hopefully afterwards or before, you get a chance to mosey around the library, because it's a phenomenal place, and you might even pick up a book to read. So, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful, and I think we at Voices from the Battlefield want to be a part of helping to get that 1,000. We want to exceed that.
Thank you. What's
your period that you have to get that in? A year?
No, okay, it's not going to take a year.
No, but I'm saying, what are you looking at for?
Oh, I would say, okay, this is how it goes. So when you file the petition, your defendants have 60 days to answer,
mm-hmm.
and if they don't, then you get a court date.
Mm-hmm.
So the power of this is that if they don't show or they don't answer, you just automatically get your expungement.
Wow.
So we're looking at maybe a 90-day window. And the other goal for Three Daughters and 1,000 Sons is to have petitions in bulk. So when
mm-hmm.
I was speaking to Judge White about it, I said, you know, if you go to eviction court, it's standing room only.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to collection court, it's standing
room
only.
You gotta go where the people are.
And so when you go for expungement, it's crickets. There's nobody here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I want to bring bulk petitions so they're standing room only in your room, your courtroom. And he threw back his head and he laughed. He said, of course. So my goal is to organize it where I'm submitting 25, 50, 60 petitions at a time, because now this is the other thing. So because St. Louis region has so many municipalities, so
mm-hmm,
many prosecutors,
mm-hmm.
to really have impact, I'm focusing on the 22nd Judicial
okay.
Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so exciting that the prosecutor's office is weighing in
mm-hmm.
on this endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
So also assembling a team of lawyers, but because I'm not an attorney, I'm doing the arrest records that weren't charged.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
And you can expunge as many of those as you want on one petition if they're eligible charges.
Okay.
So, but again, more of the minutiae will be shared on Saturday.
Okay.
Because there are one other thing, you have to not have any penalties or fees. Mm-hmm. You got to pay that.
Mm-hmm.
And it has definitely got to fall into the bucket of, was it 3 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a year ago? Was it 18 months ago? But I just really encourage the community to please come out with your questions, and we're going to do this.
See what we can get done.
Yeah.
All righty. If you have missed any of the shows, Voices from the Battlefield, you can go to JamalaRogers.com and pick those up. We got some beautiful guests coming up in the month of May. Next week is Steve Pitts. He's the guru of Black Labor Scholarship and Advocacy. We got folks coming from Jamal Burton Village to talk about their program. And we got several anniversaries this month. African Liberation Day is the anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education of Kansas. So we got folks coming in to talk about all of that, y'all. So we really got some information that's going to be coming. I want to thank Sandra Keeley again for joining us. And I just want to leave with a quote from our favorite person, Sandra, and that is Bryan Stevenson, who says, you know, we are not the worst of what we've done. And I want people to remember that when we're out there and folks have wronged our community, wronged us. Let's have some grace and some restorative justice. Thank you for joining us. This is Jamala. I'll see you on the battlefield.
We got to get it right. We got to get it right.
something to the right.